You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and A-Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, their ZDX is the most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Two Robbies podcast, your destination for in-depth discussion and analysis of all things Premier League. I'm Robbie Hill. I've got my special guest with me today, Stephen Warnock, who joins me for the show. And here are today's topics. Insanity ensures at Stamford Bridge between Chelsea and Manchester City, who battle it out in a crazy 4-4 draw. Wolves take down Tottenham with two late goals, handing Ange Postecoglou his second straight defeat. Liverpool deliver a bounce-back performance with a 3-0 win against Brentford, courtesy of Mo Salah's two goals, and Manchester United eke out another 1-0 win, this time against Luton. That's what we've got coming up in today's episode. OK, Steve Warnock, great to have you, mate. I've got to be honest, it's a pleasure to get rid of Mr. Musto for a week or two. Bless him and his good lady. I think he's going to dough off for a little trip, so very nice, yeah. And the rest of us, mate, we'll keep working. We've had another absolutely crazy week of Premier League football, drama upon drama. There's only one place to start, the Bridge, Stamford Bridge. Chelsea hosting Manchester City, a Chelsea team that at times we've seen some progress and other times I think we've all been a bit frustrated, against a Manchester City team that look like they're starting to get into gear as we know they kick on. It ended 4-4. Give me your biggest takeaway for Chelsea, because I think they become a bit of a story, really, 4-4 with the reigning champions.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talk around the game was, well, he only beat Tottenham because of the sendings-offs, which is might be true.
Yeah.
But they took a lot of positives from it. And I think going into the game, it probably suits them playing one of the top teams, Manchester City, where they're going to attack them, they're going to come out against them.
Yeah.
I think they struggle against the teams that sit a little bit deep and they find that difficult to break down. So the game sort of played into the hands. However, you're going to get punished against Manchester City if you're not on your best game.
Yeah.
The penalty early on, or in the first half, and it could have set them back. They could have felt sorry for them, sorry for themselves, got into the shells. But I just thought the response from the Chelsea players was very positive. I think during the game, what you saw was at times Chelsea at the brilliant best. At times, you also saw Chelsea at the most vulnerable as well.
Vulnerable. Yeah,
And I think that's just where Chelsea are at the moment. I think they're just on this path where they're just a little bit up and down.
Yeah.
And I think what Mauricio Pochettino is looking for is almost that flat line and then a slower trajectory just to evolve and to get better.
It's interesting because on the podcast, I've said to Musty a few times, he keeps saying about Chelsea, and I keep giving him the sign, two-year process for me, mate. It's a two-year, and I know that seems long, and I know people will say, well, he's got to get things right and the amount of money they've spent. But we're talking about young players, some in the early 20s, some this is their first Premier League season campaign, what they're going through things. So I think going through some difficult times is never a bad thing,
because
we both know in football, sometimes it's from those moments that you learn, that you get better, that you get the experience. It was really interesting, though, because before the weekend, and I'm doing my notes for the match, and I start looking through the Chelsea team, and I know in some respects, and Musty always corrects me on this, but he keeps saying it's players with potential, you know, your Mudricks and your Jacksons and your Endos and your Caicedos. He said we don't totally know what we're going to get from them yet. But I looked through the team, Steve, and I'm kind of looking and thinking, he's talented, he's got good technical ability, he's got the... And he started to make me think that There should be times in a game when Chelsea can have possession of the ball, yeah. when Chelsea can dictate a bit to Manchester City, as good as Manchester City are. I said, when I look at the two sets of teams, of course City are better and of course City have won, but the bigger things for me with that City have are maturity, experience, know-how. They know what they're doing. This Chelsea team have got none of that at the moment, but they've got talent.
Yeah.
And if they can find a way to start to get some of the maturity, and I thought it was a mature performance today, I think that's when we'll start to see the Chelsea that Poch wants, the Chelsea that the fans want, and the Chelsea that the ownership have spent this kind of money for.
Yeah, I think there's only a handful of players within the squad who've probably won majors. Mm. When you look at it and you go Thiago Silva,
yeah.
Raheem Sterling, mm-hmm. Cole Palmer to a certain degree has been in and around the changing room, but he's still young
yeah.
in football in terms of what he does on a pitch. Mm. And I completely agree. I think that game management is key to them, and I think it's something that Pochettino is very, very aware of, is that they have to get better at that. The game that strikes me is the Arsenal game.
Yeah.
2-0 up and you're cruising in the game. It's the best we've seen them play in a long time. Albeit Arsenal, were they not at the best because of Chelsea's performance, or was it just an off day? But then the mistakes creep in and then they fold. And that's the problem, is like you can't fold. It's almost you've got to brush the first mistake off and say, OK, don't worry about it. We're better than that. We can get over it. But I think that's just where Chelsea are at the moment. But I find Chelsea very interesting in the fact of the old Chelsea regime mm-hmm. of winning trophies year after year
yeah.
and has gone. There's a new ownership in town. So for me, it's almost like Chelsea's a new club. They're in a massive transitional period where you've got now owners who are new to football,
yeah.
who don't quite understand it fully. They're learning on the job. Mm. They've made huge mistakes. I think by bringing Maurizio Pochettino in, they've made a big addition to it, and I think it's a big plus what they've done in bringing him in. So I totally agree with you. I'd even stretch it longer than 2 years, the project, because I think the club had gone that far behind after Abramovich left, with the mistakes of what Todd Boehly made. Even that position of when Abramovich was sort of under investigation, the club slipped behind a year straight away, maybe longer, with what was going on at the club. So I do think it's a long process, and it's going to be a long ride for them.
I want to talk about some individuals and then maybe just turn attention on Manchester City. But before I do, I just wanted to run one, again, a bit of a theory past you in terms of, and obviously your links and knowing Liverpool Football Club well, that I sometimes feel in football and at certain football clubs, your history, that a winning history from the past can be a burden.
Oh, yeah.
I used to feel it at Liverpool, and obviously the one trophy, the one title that Jurgen Klopp is helping to address that, and the football that he's playing now is getting Liverpool back to where they were. Manchester United, I think, it's evident now. We're always harking back to the time. Chelsea, we kind of keep on talking about the winning and that mentality and the titles and the Mourinhos and the Angelottis and the Contes, and which isn't necessarily helpful. That's one point that I'd love to get your thought on. And the second is, and this one's a little bit more difficult to how would I best explain it? I've always felt at certain clubs, big clubs with that history, that winning history from the past, there's sometimes an element, small element, around clubs who don't want current success because it actually dims the successes of the past.
Yeah.
And it's a really difficult thing to try and say. But sometimes you either see it, you feel it, that there's an era where that was the golden era back in the day and this is nowhere near as good and they'll never be as good. I don't know. You were at Liverpool, they had many years, and I'm not saying that these loads of individuals or whatever who always hark back to those days. But do you understand the point I'm making?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I do.
At times, at clubs, everybody's got to be pulling, and sometimes there can be one or two bad eggs in there who actually are hankering for those past days because that was their glory time.
Yeah, I think your first point, obviously, that the pressures of being at a club and to win titles is there. The only thing I'd say about that is, and this is, I totally agree with you on that, from a player's point of view, You can't think about that. This is your era. This is your time to make history. I think a lot of the time it's fans, it's the media who put that pressure on the players. But actually, from within the change room, me and you wouldn't sit there in the change room and say, God, we need to win this. We need to get ourselves in these history books and match them.
Yeah, we're not thinking
we'd
about
like
that,
to, but that's just, well, if we do things right day to day, that'll come naturally and that'll happen. If we're coached in the right way, managed in the right way, if the right players are bought through the door, well, that'll all take care of itself naturally. The more pressure you put on yourself, the more you know, you seize up, you become less of a player, and you play you play limited in the way that you play. I think what was very interesting, and I can talk about this because I know it firsthand, is when Jurgen Klopp took over, the one thing he did was he embraced the history of the club, and he wanted the former players and the ex-players to be in and around and tell their stories about winning titles and winning cups and what the mentality was like and how they thought about games, because he thought that was vitally important. If I wanted to be a tennis player, I wouldn't go to you and ask how to become a tennis player.
Okay, because you don't,
yeah, but you don't know it, do you?
Yeah, no,
if I wanted to become a doctor, I wouldn't go and say, well, Robbie, what do I do to become a doctor? If I want to be become a winner and get a winner's mentality, I go and speak to winners and I ask them questions and I feed off them and I get that. But what you've got to get is you've got to get the right type of winners within the change room who want the club to continue to be winners and to be spoken about in the right way. And I think that's what Liverpool did. I know it's like what other clubs are doing now, that they're drawing on the past and saying to them, no, embrace that past and use it to gear you and fill you to or fuel you to be successful.
Let's just focus a couple on a couple of Chelsea players and that, and then we'll turn to Manchester City, because obviously they played their part in a brilliant game just before the international break. Cole Palmer, we made a bit about him before the game. We talked about him before kickoff. We mentioned him after. I mean, did he look like a man on a mission? A man trying to prove a point? I mean, he took the penalties so coolly with all the pressures on him. That's four penalties, four conversions, and doesn't look a problem. Did him and Raheem Sterling, who's the other, I would say, who were former players, I thought it was probably one of the best games I've seen Sterling play in the blue of Chelsea.
I thought he was brilliant. I really do. Going back to Cole Palmer, we bigged him up and he delivered. And that's the great thing. But I think when you're a bit part player at a club and suddenly you get that platform to play week in, week out, your mentality changes completely within on the training ground, around the changing room. Suddenly, when you've got the trust of a manager who brings you in, you mentioned it on the show where you said about being an academy player is different from being bought. When you get bought, suddenly you're the manager's choice, you're the club's choice, they want you. That makes you feel 10 foot tall. You feel so important and that you're there for a purpose, whereas when you're coming through the academy, you're just a product of the academy and let's see where he gets to and let's see how he does. So I think you could see that, or you can certainly see it from the performances that he's put in for Chelsea so far, that he's thriving in that environment and showcases what his sort of his attributes are. I spoke about it on the show about Jason Wilcox talking about his mentality and how he developed and how strong mentally he is. We saw that in the penalty. Going up against your former club, right at the end of the game.
Edison, one of the top goalkeepers in the league.
Exactly. And he looked so comfortable, didn't he? He looked so calm. So that shows his qualities. And I think Raheem Sterling's got a point to prove to a lot of people. Leaving Manchester City, any step from there would have been a downgrade. And he goes to Chelsea. But he's got something to prove because he wants to get back in the England squad. He wants to show to Manchester City why they shouldn't have sold him, why they should have kept him. And I thought he was outstanding today. He's coming for a little bit of criticism times. Yeah. But I think this season, we listened to him in America in the summer series where he talked about, my diet was wrong last year. It takes a lot for someone to admit that and to
when
come out and go,
successful as well.
Yeah, exactly. And go, I tried something, it didn't work, and now I've got back to what I am. Yeah. And look at my performances.
I thought it was a great moment when he scored, because he kind of started to celebrate, then didn't, and then saw his mate. I thought it was a brilliant moment. Just tells you what was going on inside. From City's point of view, let's turn it. Pep talked after about actually being pleased with the point. I think Pep, and I heard him in his press conference before the game started, actually, was, I think he sees the potential in what Pochettino has, the potential in the group, and said, this isn't going to be an easy fixture. Anybody who thinks, come to Stamford Bridge, I think he's known in the past what it's like. I think he knows the crowd are up for it, the players are up for it. And in the end, it's probably a good point for Man City in the end.
Yeah, I think he'd have probably took it before the game, going to Chelsea, having been 4-3 ahead so late on. Yeah. That'll be sort of sat in his mind thinking, well, we should have saw that one out. However, we've seen Chelsea against Liverpool this season, and Liverpool dominated the first half, but then Chelsea were magnificent in the second half and really dominated possession. The Arsenal game for 77 minutes before Declan Rice scores that goal. Arsenal are well and truly played off the park by Chelsea, who were brilliant on the day. So he knew, watching those videos, and I go back to the styles of playing against Chelsea.
Yeah.
It suits Chelsea to play a Manchester City, a Liverpool or an Arsenal who come onto them, who want to hem them back in, and then they can counter-attack. So I thought his interview was refreshing, actually, because usually he's so uptight and a bit moans, and he just said, which is exactly what we were thinking, what an advert for the Premier League.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't a great day, I don't think, for too many of the City players. A couple of points I made after the game. I thought they missed John Stones. Yeah. I think how important he's become. Not just his defending and his organisation. Now when he steps into midfield, gives them the overload, he understands his role, where he's passing, how he can get it into the attacking third. I thought they missed that. I thought Rodri, at times, got a little bit drawn around the pitch. He missed a couple of the challenges he normally makes. One player I think we'd probably overlook again, and we shouldn't, is Erling Haaland. He's got 13 Premier League goals, which is incredible, in 12 Premier League games. On a season when people are saying, oh, he's not quite the same, and comparing him to last year. I mean, whatever happens, what an incredible potential, because he's still, I think he's 23 at the moment. Yeah. Incredible potential that this guy's got, and a hunger to be in the right place, to get goals, some fortune, I think, in the penalty, and we should actually just quickly discuss that. But Erling Haaland is a gift for the Premier League.
Oh, absolutely. And we want the best players within the Premier League. Yeah. I think we were all worried he might go to La Liga, but we were fortunate that he came to Manchester City and to the Premier League. The one thing I remember listening to a story about him, I read it, and it was talking about his dad would often catch him watching videos of him missing opportunities. And he was like, why are you watching those ones? And he was like, because I want to learn why I miss them and how to get better at them, whether I need to be quicker with my touch, whether my movement needs to be a bit different. So it's almost that perfectionist in him and that drive and that hunger to just keep breaking records, to keep scoring goals. You can see the joy he gets out of the tapping or any type of goal.
Same thing.
Everything means the same to him. That is what he is there to do. I think the other side of it, I think his all-round game's getting better, his link-up play. I think it's taken him a while to get to that. But like you say, he's young. He is still quite raw in the respect of holding the ball up and bringing others into play. That game intelligence, that experience that you do get when you get older to play a certain style. But I just love his hunger to score goals. It's a defender's worst nightmare, isn't it? When you see him sort of bearing down on you, that power that he's got in around the penalty area, that upper body strength, and then how clinical he is.
Let's just clean up that VAR on the penalty as well, because we were in studio, we saw it. I think we both sort of looked at it a couple of times, thought, not quite sure about it, and then we saw a couple of replays. And I think we both felt that Erling Haaland instigated the grab on Cucurella.
Yeah.
Cucurella reacts by grabbing back, and then as the ball's coming in, there's an isolated shot of Cucurella with his arms around Haaland, who goes down. I didn't think it was a penalty. I don't think you thought it was a penalty in the end. And I'm just glad that we're not talking about VAR. The game went on beyond there, and fortunately, it didn't become the most, the talking point if it was a 1-0 win, say, to City. And I just felt on that one, it was almost like I felt the referee Anthony Taylor didn't need to give anything, and then we'll go to VAR, have a look at it and see. But I think by giving it, it's then never going to be deemed a clear and obvious error. And that was one of those situations. I felt today, with 20 minutes on the clock, I thought, what a great game we set up. Chelsea had started well. They were causing problems in the wide areas and doubling up, and Doku and James was a great play out. And then I almost felt like VAR wanted to inject itself in the game. Let's have a VAR. That's 20 minutes of good football. Now let's have a VAR. I just felt he didn't need to get involved.
No, I do a show at home called Ref Watch with former Premier League referee Dermot Gallagher. And it's something that I said when we were looking at the goals was, sometimes the best thing is to do nothing because it could go either way.
Yeah.
And don't influence it, just let it ride out. Mm-hmm. And after the game, we'd have all looked at it and gone, I've seen them given. You could see it going the other way as mm-hmm. well. So maybe the best thing is sometimes is to do nothing. Yeah. But I agree with VAR, they look to intervene at every opportunity.
Yeah.
Even the Haaland goal when he scores, and they're looking
to find
for a handball, and you're thinking,
come on,
let's not talk about it. I mean, the one thing I thought this weekend coming into the studio was, let's hope we don't get any major VAR controversies.
Yeah. We don't want them. We all do, don't we, football
exactly.
fans? We want to see the game play and
absolutely.
Play out.
When you buy a new house, you might say,
shut the front door.
Winning.
No, seriously, shut the front door. We own this house now.
But you actually need to say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. The local State Farm agent is there to help you choose the coverage you need.
Welcome to my crib. No one says that anymore, but I don't care.
So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Anyway, we're not going to finish this on VAR, but we are going to move on to Molineux. Tottenham went away to Wolves. Having lost their first game of the week, obviously the circumstances are on Monday to Chelsea, two players sent off, lots of injuries, you know, all kinds of problems for Ange Postecoglou. So they go to Wolverhampton Wanderers. They go one up early through a Brennan Johnson goal, and then later on concede two goals, which means back-to-back defeats for Spurs. We've just done a breakdown on the tactics show, which is on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. Anyone who wants to have a look at that, just look at the two goals that Spurs concede. Is it as simple as saying, because of who wasn't there, that possibly caused the defeat, or should the players out there, the 11, have done a little bit better?
I think there's a little bit of both. I think if you've got Van de Ven and Maddison, I think the game's different. I really do. I think Maddison gets on the ball more. They dominate possession. They create more opportunities. Van de Ven play that higher line. You can get back into positions. Mm-hmm. I said to you when we were watching the game, we were chatting about it, and I was saying, Van de Ven, we talk about his pace, but it's actually the reading of the game, his understanding, and he's such a young player. Mm-hmm. He's had the same effect, I feel, that Van Dijk's had on Liverpool. He's come in, he's got that stature, that aura about him. You almost see opposition forwards looking at him thinking, don't fancy taking him on in a 1v1, or I don't quite think I've got the strength to out-muscle him and things like that. So already he's got a psychological upper hand on people, which is a great thing to have. The other side of it, you'd look at it and go, well, you've got two international centre-halves playing, Eric Dier and Ben Davis. Mm. Should they be able to deal with runners through them, through passes?
Yeah.
They should, but late on in the game, when you haven't played that many minutes, legs are tired, mind's tired. It's like the constant pressure that comes on you.
Yeah.
If that was maybe two games down the line and they'd have two lots of 90 minutes in the legs and then they get to that stage, I think they see the game out. I don't think they're as mentally tired and physically tired. And that's something that you look at, and Postecoglou, I'm sure, listen, he's a smart guy, isn't he? He's probably looking at the same thing, thinking, we could have defended it, we could have done better, but it's a big task.
You're dead right, because I did hear a bit of a press conference last night after the game, and he sort of said, you know, I was a little concerned for some of the players who haven't played at that level for that long time. You know, Eric Dier's first Premier League start. It does, you know, that fatigue sometimes is in the head as much as in the legs, and you're switching off and you're looking for a rest. It's interesting because actually, having done the breakdown we did on the second goal, which is the Lamina goal from the free kick, a thought's just come back to my head, and it came through when we were watching Newcastle training the summer series away in America. I remember Eddie Howe going through some game type situations, and the opposition had the ball. And the first thing Eddie Howe coached was one of his players to get in front of the ball and stop a quick free kick. So he had Almiron doing it. He had I think Trippier doing it. He had Joe Ellington doing it at times. You don't always have the same player. And he did a little thing which made me laugh and I thought very clever. He said he had the player to get in front of the ball and then go down and tie his laces as if he's doing his laces. Now, most of the players haven't got laces in the boots anyway, so no. I don't know how that was. But obviously, it's just a ploy to stop the opposition playing a quick free kick so you can get organised.
Yeah.
And I remember now watching the second Spurs goal today, and anybody gets a chance to look, his referee gives a free kick, Wolves want to take it quickly, Emerson Royal gets involved with trying to run in and kicking the ball away, that gets him out of position. But the big thing, it's just come back to me, is that no Spurs player thinks about getting in front of the ball and stopping a quick free kick, which just gives us time to fill our holes in behind, get our organisation, and maybe give us a chance to defend. We're now talking 90 plus 7 minutes in the game. It's at 1-1, so Rabia scored one. Yeah. Lamina's running forward. Could they have, you know, just a bit of thought and maybe a bit of discipline have saved that situation?
And you're talking about, in those positions, you're talking about Højbjerg. Yeah. And then you're talking about Bentancourt, two experienced players who should know better, should be thinking in that position, get on top of it, do something. Yeah. I think Son was in and around the same area as well, another experienced player. But then I go back to them tired minds again. Yeah. Is that part of it? Mm. Is there enough leadership on the pitch for someone to do that? Mm. Son's not that type of... Son's a leader of... like showing what he can
do
on the
pitch. The way he plays, take a lead from
He's
that.
Not a shouter and a baller and an organiser. Mm. And do they need that figure in midfield to be able to do that? Because I think when you go back to Newcastle there and you make a great example of it, Kieran Trippier is the one straight away you'd be thinking, he's in his head, like he's played for Simeone.
Yeah, yeah.
Simeone knows the dark arts of the games, and that's how you slow a game down. Mm. It's how you frustrate teams, and that's what you've got to do. Mm. But I just think when he'd on the pitch, he'd be the one saying, get in front of the free kick, slow it down, make sure it happens. Yeah, but it's a great point.
Just wonder with back-to-back defeats now for Spurs in the space of, six days, has the break sort of come at a good time? You get one or two, I know, injuries, and these, you know, we're talking about Van de Ven and Maddison being maybe next year before we see them in the white, but other players, suspension, Udogie comes back, he was only one game suspended, Romario we know is three, which makes it a little bit difficult. But has the break almost come at a good time, go away, come back together again, we go again kind of thing?
Yeah, and I think also as well, if there is a game this weekend, all the media's attention will be on Tottenham.
Good shout,
What's the response going to be? How are they going to deal with this situation? Exactly.
Yeah.
From suddenly having this unbelievable start, we go back to being Spursy. And that's the problem. That's the title they want to get away from. So it's a case of, I'm sure, it's very difficult with an international break. Because for a team like Tottenham, they'll have multiple internationals within the changing room who will be going away on international breaks now. So it's not a case of where Ange Postecoglou can get them in and sort of get a little bit of a reset and look back at the work they've done and go, hang about, lads, would you have taken this at the beginning of the season?
Yeah, for sure.
Because the position we were in, no one would have put us in this position. They'd have probably said we'd have been around 7th or 8th, and how's Postecoglou getting on? Yeah. Can he have an impact on them? And he's not quite done what he'd wanted to. Well, they're in a magnificent position, so take the positives from it. I think that's what they've got to do, and they've got to just sort of take stock by taking a step back from the situation, the international break, and going, no, we're in a great position here.
Absolutely. And I just want to give a mention, actually, to Gary O'Neill, because he's a guy often that's not in the spotlight in many respects. I think he was on Sky Football, Monday Night Football, a few weeks ago, showed a little bit of his coaching and how he works. I think startled one or two people and got people's attention. And just as the Wolves manager, his team play good football. They're well set up. They've had some terrible decisions go against them, VAR and the likes. I mean, I think the back-to-back penalties that have been given against them that weren't. I think they got an apology this weekend for
Newcastle,
one
wasn't
last
it?
Week.
Yeah.
It was Hee Chang Wang, the first one, and then Fabio Silva, I think it was, last weekend.
That's three penalties then, the Luton one as well.
And so it's they've had some terrible luck. But I just think he's one of those managers who... I think people are starting to warm to. People are starting to understand how good he is. He's working with the group. You know, he went under difficult circumstances. I think he had 4 days training before the start of the season. We saw them play at Man United, where they played United off the park and lost 1-0 the first day. But, you know, difficult time. But, again, a guy who wants to coach, who gets players better. And Wolves play some good football, I tell you. They're a decent football team. So a little bit of credit to Gary O'Neill. OK, mate, let's move it on to Anfield. I'm sure you're looking forward to speak to this. Liverpool at home to Brentford. Brentford can always be difficult opposition to play. Thomas Frank has his team, excuse me, well set up. But Liverpool, no problem, 3-0-1. Two goals for Mo Salah, one for Diogo Jota. Is that almost what Liverpool need? I kind of feel with Liverpool, and I want to get your view, is... I said the other week, it's almost to me like Liverpool are still trying to convince themselves they're title contenders. It's like people are saying, oh, Liverpool, is this a team? And listen, they're in good shape at the moment, sit second in the table, 1 point behind City. But are they really title contenders, do you think, this time around?
I'm still not convinced about them defensively. From the aspect of Trent Alexander-Arnold playing in this inside position. Now, Manchester City tried it with Kyle Walker moving into that position. He tried it with also Zinchenko when he was at the club. And it didn't quite work because you're vulnerable and susceptible to counter-attacks on that side. And Konate, when he plays on that side, often gets caught either ball-watching because teams are clever now. What they do is they'll play a winger high on the left and they'll bring the striker out to the left-hand side as well. So then Konate's got this conundrum. Which one do I go in on? If I go tight on the striker, there's a ball in behind for the winger and that causes problems. If I go wide enough onto the winger, leaves this big gap through to the striker, and he's caught in like that position at the moment where he doesn't quite know how to deal with it. I don't think McAllister's a number six. I don't think he's senses danger enough to play in that position. When I look at Rodri, he senses it. He knows when people move into certain positions.
Can he learn that, do you think? Or is that something that's
I don't think he's athletically good enough to do
get
it.
Across the pitch.
Yeah,
I
think he's one of those players. He's a brilliant footballer. But play him to his strengths. Yeah. And listen, I'm not sitting here telling Jürgen Klopp what to do, but I just think his best position's higher up. When you look at him at Brighton and especially Argentina in the World Cup, I thought he was the second best player in the tournament. I really do, behind Messi. Messi was unbelievable, but McAllister was phenomenal in that forward advanced position, retaining balls, little threaded through passes. So I think if you want to get the best out of him, you've almost got to play him in that position. The other thing I think with Liverpool is Szoboszlai's your mainstay.
Yeah.
But then you look at it and go, well, who's the other two? Who fits in there? I think Curtis Jones does when he's fit. I think what Jürgen Klopp's got out of him is he knows tactically exactly how to play the game. And also, his passing accuracy, his passing retention is the highest in the Liverpool team. Is also his turnover of possession and winning it back is the highest in the midfield, which is a great
impressive.
It's impressive.
Especially the way Liverpool play.
And I think there's...
What about Gravenberch? Every time I see him, I kind of like what I see. All the tools and the raw material looks there.
Young and inexperienced, I think there's a side of him. But I also think there's a side where he's just getting used to playing again. He's had a year out of playing at Bayern Munich. So that's a long time in football. And even your body getting up to speed probably didn't have a full proper pre-season because you're a bit in limbo. Am I staying? Am I going? Where am I at? You sort of drop your standards because you're feeling a little bit sorry for yourself. So I think there's a side where he'll get better in time. But I do like him. He's a more an advanced centre midfielder. Loves getting on the half turn. Drives with the ball so well. So it's just that defensive minded midfielder
when
Endo's not quite at the level.
Yeah, it's interesting. One man we have to mention, just as we move on from Liverpool, is Mo Salah. I think it's double figures again for him. His productivity in terms of goals and assists. I mean, to even think about what a sale would have looked like for Liverpool or will look like in the future. I said today when we were doing the highlights and you watch him and he slips one in, typical, opens his body up from that right-hand side. He gets a header that he nonchalantly puts in and waits to see if he's onside. He is. He's already at double figures. I think we sometimes in football take for granted the art of putting the ball in the back of net and how difficult it is. This guy makes it look easy. And I said today, he's a modern great. He's a modern Premier League great. And it'll be only when he's gone and we start looking back at the history and the record books and what he's done that maybe he'll get the appreciation he deserves.
Yeah, he certainly gets the appreciation from Liverpool fans. They know what he's capable of. They know what he's churning out game after game. The big thing when you watch Mohamed Salah is, and I just wonder whether this is why it didn't work for him at Chelsea, is that... At times, he can do nothing in the game. and it can have a real tough time. I think back to the derby against Everton. Mikalenko marked him out of the game.
Yeah.
Mikalenko was brilliant. Mm. Suddenly, bang, blink of an eye, does something, scores a goal, and you think, where did that come from? And his stats stack up from a statistician point of view. Yeah. Everyone looks at him and goes, goals, assists.
Yeah.
But when you actually watch his all-round game, you go, he doesn't have an effect at times, and he can be quite sloppy, and he can be a little bit sort of on the periphery of the game.
Yeah.
But within a blink of an eye, he can just score a goal or create something out of nowhere.
It's a special talent, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's why you can never really take him off the pitch, because you know he's got that in his armoury. He's a phenomenal player.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do think if Liverpool are going to challenge for a title, Mo Salah's going to be a big part of that goals from that right-hand side. OK, let's move it on to Old Trafford. So, a bit of a tension back on Manchester United, losing against Copenhagen 4-3 in the Champions League. Marcus Rashford getting sent off. More kind of pressure and headlines on Erik ten Hag. So, this was a game that I set out. My note before the game was, United can't lose this game. It's one of those days where if United lose this game, it's all on. They didn't lose the game. They scored through Lindelof from a corner kick. They won against Luton 1-0. Good win, not a great performance. Is that where we are with Liverpool now, or do standards, or should standards maybe be higher?
The standards at Manchester United should always be higher. I just think there's a real lack of belief, whether it's in each other as players, whether it's in the system that they're playing. I think it's very interesting, though. They still sit sixth or seventh in the league at the moment.
They're 3 points behind fourth. Well, they were 3 points behind fourth. They're now, sixth in the table on 21 points. Fifth is Villa on 25 points, and fourth is Tottenham on 26 points. So
it's not a terrible position, is it? And we're all
looking
at them.
3-4 points. We're thinking like they're 16th or something, which they're not.
But I think a lot of it has come from the Carling Cup defeat to Newcastle at home, 3-0, and then that was after the 3-0 against Manchester City at home. Yeah. So we're looking at that over aggregate going, saying they've been beat 6-0 at home over two games.
Yeah.
And you look at that and go, it's not great. But then the Champions League form hasn't been great. But in the Premier League, they've gone about the business okay-ish. They're in a position now where you go, if you go on a run and we start to click a little bit, we start to believe in ourselves and believe in each other, we could actually sort of mount a challenge to get in that top four.
It can come with wins, can't it? It's amazing how, and sometimes our listeners and viewers might not understand, how much a win changes the dressing room and the training ground and how you work. And sometimes you haven't played well, and you kind of know you haven't played well. But as you say, you look at the table and you go, oh, we're sixth. Yeah. We're not playing well. Listen, if we kick into gear a little bit, we can go kick on again. And I suppose that's what Erik ten Hag is continually pushing out the narrative, that we're not as bad as you lot keep saying we are.
No. I think the big thing is that we're all... And rightly so, I think, anyway, in my opinion, is that we all look for an identity of a team, don't we?
Yeah.
So we want to see how a team plays and what their style is. When I look at Manchester City, even Chelsea today, I can see what they're trying to do, Arsenal, Liverpool. When I watch Aston Villa, we get exactly what their ideas are on the pitch and what they're trying to achieve. When I watch Manchester United, it's just reactive football. And that's the issue, whereas, like, Manchester United, with the money they've spent, shouldn't be a team who sits deep and counter-attacks.
Yeah.
I understand when the chips are really low and you've probably sold a few players or they've lost a manager and a new manager comes in. But Ten Hag's had, what, sort of a year and a half, nearly a year and a half in
with
charge now.
Choice of a number of players.
Yeah, so have they progressed? I think they've regressed. I don't think they've got any better.
It's interesting, I looked at the bench this weekend, and then you've got Varane, who there, you talked about winners and talking to winners as a winner, was on the bench.
Yeah.
There was no Johnny Evans, but it was Maguire and Lindelof, so he's not getting in ahead of Maguire and Lindelof. Amrabat was one they've chased and talked about. He was sitting on the bench. And Mason Mount, who you're going to spend a big lump of money on, and then you're playing Luton at home, and Mason Mount's on the bench.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I scratch my head and say, what's the plan here? What's the joined up thinking? You know, why on these days is Mason Mount not in your first 11 if he's fit?
Well, that's a big question, isn't it? Is it a case of Mason Mount's just not playing well? Is it that they've seen something else in him and it's not quite right what they've seen, and they don't believe he's the player that they thought he was? But to put all the money into him with a year remaining on his contract, it was, what, over £55 million, so what's that, $65 million-ish? You look at that and say, that's a big gamble to take on someone in the last year of his contract. Plus, the contract he will be on as well, wages-wise, will be huge. So it was a big gamble. I think there's something more with Varane. You see the clips during the week, and it looked very frosty and hostile between him and Ten Hag and his backroom staff. It's almost like Varane's looking very frustrated and isn't happy with the situation. And would you be? I don't think you would be. No, I think you'll feel every pro backs themselves to play.
You want to play, don't you? Yeah. And I'm sure if you're Varane at this stage of his career, he's going to want to play games. And I suppose we've got Marcus Rashford, who 17 goals last season, 30 all comps, looks a shadow of that player. And Hoyland, who, it's amazing, he looks confident playing in Champions League and he's got his 5 goals, just can't find a bit of luck, find the right contact to get a goal in the Premier League. Yeah. Had a couple of chances again against Luton and wasn't able to find the back of the net.
But that one was a really interesting signing to me.
Hoyland?
Because if I look at Hoyland, I like him as a player,
I think he's potential. I think he's could be a top player.
But what does he feed off? Crosses. So you've got Garnacho on one side, he wants to chop, weave in and out.
Yeah.
And you think, does he really deliver quality balls into the box?
Yeah, we wondered if that's why he's playing Rashford on the right, didn't he? Maybe to put a cross in, and he actually did, didn't he?
He just missed it at the back post ever so slightly. But you're looking at wingers, when Rashford plays on that left, he's not going to be one who's going to get it out of his feet and really whip a great ball into the box, is he?
No, that's
so if that's not going to happen, well, get to the byline, set it back for your fullbacks, and then put quality into the box. Yeah. If Hoyland must be wondering himself, like, what have I joined here? Yeah. I want service. I want balls in the box. I want to go and attack balls and win headers and things like that. And I think he's got that. Well, he's definitely got that in his game, because we've seen it. So you've got to play to your striker's strengths.
Mm, absolutely. So a little bit of work more for Ten Hag to do, but a win is a win. 3 points are 3 points, and is it six in the table?
When you buy a new house, you might say,
shut the front door.
Winning.
No, seriously, shut the front door. We own this house now.
But you actually need to say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. The local State Farm agent is there to help you choose the coverage you need.
Welcome to my crib. No one says that anymore, but I don't care.
So just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Okay, mate, we'll sort of look at some of the other results and important score lines. Let's start at the Emirates. Arsenal facing Burnley. So Burnley having a bit of a tough time under Vincent Kompany, but relationship between Kompany and Arteta from the old Man City days. So there was a lot of getting on between the two benches. But Arsenal got the job done. I know you kept a little bit of an eye on this one. And Trossard gets the first goal. Brownhill brings them back level. And then Saliba with the header and Zinchenko with a beautiful kind of scissors kick got the goals for Arsenal. And I just felt it was one of those days where it was a bit of a feel-good day for Arsenal. They kind of got their football back, they got a few goals, and you know, they're probably feeling better about themselves.
Yeah, more so the second half. I think in the first half, Burnley had a go, made a bit of a game of it, had a few opportunities, and I think they're obviously shot-shy. Burnley in the final third, they lack a little bit of creativity.
Foster's been missing for a while, isn't he?
Yeah, which is a real shame, and we wish him good luck as well, and get him feeling better soon.
Yeah.
But I think there's a side of it where you just go, from Arsenal's point of view, it's like, we've got more gears to go through this, so even when they got back into the game, it was like, come on, lads, we can sort this out.
So it was Trossard as a false nine.
Yeah.
With Martinelli one side,
Saka, Saka the other side.
Kai Havertz involved.
Yeah, misses a good header, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Misses a header from sort of 5 yards out. It's interesting, isn't it? Everyone always says, who watches him, oh, there's a player there.
Yeah, there's a player in there.
Is he the training ground player that you've always played with throughout your career, who is brilliant on the training ground but can't quite hit that next level on the pitch? Is there something that he fears going onto the pitch where he doesn't feel comfortable? Has it got to a point where he's overthinking about the game and overthinking about what people are going to be saying about him, and there's just that element of doubt in his mind? For one reason or another, it's not happening for him at the moment, and that'll be a concern for Mikel Arteta.
It was interesting, though, because I read last night Arteta was saying good things about him and that he hasn't got to... And I was saying, I think that's good management, because I think he's making sure his confidence stays high. But eventually, at some point, he's either got to play Havertz and get him through and nurse him into getting some goals and being effective, or... It's difficult to have a squad when you're playing a player who isn't really doing it week in, week out, and you're training hard and going like, come on, Gaffer, when's my time?
Yeah, and that's the point about bringing people in for big money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is you almost feel like, well, he's going to have to play him. Mm. If Kai Havertz had been bought for, say, $30 million, we'd have all gone, oh, he's a good squad player.
Yeah.
He'll fit in for a squad player. And I think there'd be an almost...
He was bought to go in the first 11, wasn't he?
Yeah. And I think there was an element of... A lot of Arsenal fans, a lot of sort of the media pundits are saying they shouldn't have bought him and they shouldn't have bought Raya and they should have gone all in on a number nine and got that big number nine. Mm. But I think Arteta's sort of argument to that was, well, I'd rather have more goals scattered about.
Yeah.
I think he'd get more goals for him, and he hasn't done that.
No,
I think it was the penalty away at Bournemouth is the only goal he scored.
Yeah, when
and it was given to him.
Yeah,
so he hasn't really created anything.
I've got to be honest, I was one of those who didn't mind it. I kind of saw bits of what I liked in Havertz and, you know, big goals and moments for Chelsea, and thought, actually, if he gets in those spots where Granit Xhaka used to get, I think he's got creative ability. He might, you know, he can find a goal, he can find a pass. But you're right, it hasn't happened for him, and
it's a shame.
It is a shame, and it's one of those things that at some point, you know, Mikel Arteta might have to deal with. But I suppose if they're winning and he's still in the team, then, you know, people say less about it. Little bit of worry for any worries for Burnley. They sit bottom of the table now, and, you know, great football last year, 101 points, but hasn't quite worked since they've come up. One win at the moment, and another defeat. Not great from set pieces again from Vincent Kompany, which you would think his team of all would be better. Might you have to change his style, his philosophy? Might he have to become a little bit more pragmatic to get some points and give them a platform?
He went a little bit more direct in this game against Arsenal and tried to change things a little bit, and he actually got joy from it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't like the ball over the top of them.
Yeah.
They don't like running back towards their own goal or turn them in behind. There's a real snobbery around football where we want to see this perfect game played. There's only Manchester City and a few other teams that can play that style of football. When you think about it, Liverpool, Manchester City and Arsenal can go toe-to-toe. Tottenham to a certain degree, at full strength. You look at those teams and they can go toe-to-toe at the moment. There's not many others who can do it. So why try and play them at their own game? You've got to try and adapt in different ways.
I think you've got your De Zerbis and your Unai Emerys who've got a version of it, haven't they? And they play in a way that suits their players
Absolutely.
And suits their system. But it's not all out the same way. These triggers and these safety mechanisms if things start to go wrong.
Yeah, and that's what you've got to find, isn't it? You've got to find what suits the players. I think you're asking these players playing against tactically better players in the Premier League than the Championship who see things quicker, adapt to things quicker, react to things quicker, will sort things out on the pitch quicker rather than looking at the manager and going, how do we sort this out? Yeah. Top players just go... sorted, and they get it done quickly, and I think that's where they're struggling to deal with it.
Yeah, bit of work for Vincent Kompany. Let's go to the Vitality. Interesting game here. Bournemouth hosting Newcastle. Eddie Howe taking Newcastle back to where he was a player and a manager with much success. Iriola's had a bit of a tough time at Bournemouth, and people were questioning, maybe is he trying to do too much with a group of players who are not up to what he wanted to do, and he was sort of talking about his messages are getting across. Bournemouth end up winning the game 2-0. Goals by Dominic Solanke, 60th minute, 73rd minute. On a day when I actually thought Newcastle didn't really turn up. I know they've had Champions League, got beat by Dortmund, they've got some injuries, Isak and like Wilson out, a number of players, you know, suspensions for Tonali, Bruno Guimaraes not available. So there was reasons, and there's a, you could say excuses for Newcastle, but I think Eddie Howe would expect a little bit more from a team that he put out that was still a decent side.
Yeah, I really do as well. And I think the other side of it as well, one of the players that you didn't mention there, is one of those unsung players, is Dan Byrne. Can play across the back line, very comfortable, big stature from set pieces, from both attacking and defending, but also what they've got across that back line, which they lose when Livramento comes in or Lewis Hall. Great experience, know-how, under pressure. How do we deal with it? If it needs to go, it goes. Not overplaying, trying to impress the manager and trying to impress to get in the team, trying to do too much. And I think there's an element at that of times at the weekend. But they just looked like it was a game too far.
Yeah.
They looked like they needed the international break. They almost needed to limp over the line against Bournemouth, get a result, and then sort of take stock and go, phew, it's been a tough couple of weeks, tough one to me to say, and then just sort of take stock and look at it and sort of address it. But there's that Champions League element as well. They're travelling, they're getting adapting the training sessions, making sure all that's right. Whether Eddie Howe will look at that himself and go, okay, maybe I need to adapt something and change something, sit down with his medical staff over this period and say, are we getting something wrong here? Can we change something? Feedback from the players as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because Almiron went off with looked like a muscle injury. Fabian Schär was holding his hamstring, looked like could have some kind of muscle injury. And, you know, it was almost like you were watching the players thinking, geez, who's going to be next?
Yeah.
And I think I said last week, week before on the podcast, I just wonder if Eddie Howe has to find another version of his Newcastle team that doesn't have to rely on being all out all the time. We saw him, we spent some time with him in the Premier League Summer Series watching him training. He's as sort of driven for training as is for games, about working hard and that. And I just wonder if it's some, you know, with the games, with all that they've got, you know, similar players doing the same thing each week, does he have to take a little bit of the load away? Could there be a bit more of a resting in possession? So having the ball and maybe not working it through the team, but, you know, having a breather at times and then going again. Not this kind of, it's almost like this full on, you know, driving at everything. And I worry a little bit that they're picking up so many muscle injuries on a regular basis.
Yeah, I think when you think about the style of play, the way you get to that style of play and that intensity is by doing it in training every day.
You've got to do it,
and that becomes mentally fatiguing. When you come in, you go, this is going to be a tough session, and you're thinking it's repetitive. And I remember the year that Liverpool won the league, so the previous season to that, a few of the senior players went into Jurgen Klopp and said, this is tough mentally for the players to continue to do this. There's got to be some respite at some point where we have a down day or something, a day off or a couple of days off within the week, and we're willing to do the work, but we're shattered doing it. We're really struggling to do this. How can we do that? Whether that needs a senior figure from the Newcastle players to actually go and speak to Eddie Howe and say, this is where we're at. But often when you're doing so well, you don't want to question the manager, but there's got to be a bit of...
Yeah, relationship. I think that Eddie probably got a good relationship with the players, so we'll see. Just before we move on, mate, we do a award each week for our underappreciated performer of the week, a player who maybe hasn't got the headlines, who doesn't always get the appreciation that maybe he deserved. And my underappreciated performer of the week is a Bournemouth player. He's a Bournemouth striker. He's Dominic Solanke, who got the two goals that won the game for Bournemouth this weekend. I thought he benefited from a decent team performance. And the first goal, and we did a little breakdown on it, was a great example of Iriola's press, where they kept Newcastle one side of the pitch. They got the ball. They won it back quickly. Solanke got on the end of things, smashed it past Pope, and they go 1-0 up and improvised well for his second goal. But Dominic Solanke is a player who I feel at times doesn't get the credit he deserves. He often plays as a lone striker. He sometimes feeds on scraps because his team aren't dominating possession. He's got six goals already in the league this season. He only got six all of last season. He's a threat. He's got good size. He's technically proficient when the ball goes into him and he can join him with midfield players. And he's just one of those forwards who I think we take for granted in this league. And for a goal scorer, for somebody regularly who can find the back of the net, they're worth their weight in goal. So Dominic Solanke is my underappreciated performer of the week.
A good choice as well. Mm. Yeah, I think when he comes into the club, I think it was around about $25 million from Liverpool pounds.
Yeah.
Mm. So roughly what $30 odd million, which is it's a big fee for Bournemouth at that point. And then that pressure comes on his shoulders. I think it's taken him a little bit of time to adapt to the Premier League. And we forget when he moved to Bournemouth from Liverpool, he was a young lad.
Yeah.
So and there was a lot expected of him to come in. Mm. I almost feel that time in the Championship. To go and score goals, it helped him and took that. Got him a lot of goals in the Championship, and then he was like, "Well, I'm actually the main man." Mm. Yeah, so credit to him because he's had a real good season so far.
Okay, let's move it to London Stadium. West Ham 3, Nottingham Forest 2. We obviously both did this game this morning. 5-goal thriller. Paquetá gets West Ham off to a great start. Awoniyi gets equaliser just before half time. And Lange gets Nottingham Forest ahead, and then they almost switch off, go to sleep. Bowen and Suchet with the goals for West Ham. I thought it was a good day for West Ham. I thought they started well, they finished well. I thought there's a bit of a consistency. And I see an evolving West Ham where I looked at the team sheet today. You've got Paquetá, you've got Kudos, you've got Ward-Prowse, you've got Bowen. You've got people who want to get on the ball and make things play. You know, and sometimes with David Moyes' teams, we've always thought about, you know, the industry and the effort. So I think there's a balance, and I just thought he got a good performance out of his team today. And in the end, that's a really good win for West Ham. I mean, we're coming off the back of 3 straight defeats. You were saying, and I know you've got a good relationship with Steve Cooper and spoke to him before the game. He'll be disappointed, won't he? Haven't got 2-1 up, and the nature of the goals. And you made a great point before the match, was saying that they've got to cut out errors, whether it's team errors or individual errors. You know, the teams are good enough in the Premier League, they don't need a leg up.
No.
They're almost giving teams opportunities.
Yeah, 3 minutes into the game, you can't be passing the ball across the front of your back line and not expect to be punished when it's cut out or takes a deflection, but it shouldn't have even got to that point. Mm. Also, 2 set pieces, you'd be bitterly disappointed. But the big thing for me is that once you go 2-1 ahead, tails are up, you're thinking, here we go. And they say that the old saying in football is you're at your most vulnerable when you've just scored. 123 seconds later, you can see the goal. It can't happen.
Yeah.
It's such a bad position to put yourself in. Suddenly you go, everyone's sort of arguing between themselves as to why it's happened. And then there's a negativity around the team then. So, you'll be bitterly disappointed with that.
Yeah, but good win for West Ham. So addresses their 3-3 game losing run that they were on in the Premier League. Crystal Palace 2, Everton 3. I get the sense Sean Dyche's work is starting to have effect. In Dyche we trust, as I always say to Musty. Mikalenko again in the goals. Eze gets a penalty back in the side for Crystal Palace, who was a real threat. Doucouré, who is becoming an absolute diamond for Dyche, Abdoulaye Doucouré with a goal. Edouard gets one back after a bit of a mix-up between the goalkeeper and Tarkowski, they get that wrong. And then Idrissa Gueye comes on 86 minutes and gets the winner for Everton. So sometimes it's a great way to win as well, isn't it? A late winner away from home. Can you imagine? And then all the lads going back and, you know, Everton on a decent run of form. And I just get the sense that both parties, the manager and the dressing room, are starting to understand and appreciate each other.
Yeah. I think one of the big things for me is that I was at the last game of the season last year when he beat Bournemouth.
Oh, yeah, we were over that time.
I spoke to a few of the staff and I said, what did he say after the game? And he was like, do not celebrate this like it's something that should be achieved. It's not an achievement. Mm. This should never be happening at Everton Football Club. This shouldn't be the standard in this changing room. And I think when you try and set that mentality out, you've got to back it up. You've got to make sure the players work hard every day. But I think what he did really well was he bought Ashley Young in, great experience in and around the changing room, a winning mentality, standards are set. I played with Ash at Aston Villa. I know what he's like. He's on you if you're not doing it right. And I think they needed that. They needed that leader within the changing room, not just Seamus Coleman's voice, someone who's actually playing week in, week out. The other thing I think he did really well was he bought in Jack Harrison. and it brought a balance to the team. Yeah. So everything wasn't then reliant on McNeil to deliver. Yeah. Now you take it, because if you wanted to play Everton, well, just show everything down the right hand side, because we don't want it on the danger man, McNeil. Mm. Now you've got two players on either side who are capable of creating.
Yeah.
And we saw it at the weekend for the first goal. Yeah. Jack Harrison, lovely ball in for Mikulenko. So I think they're just a better balanced team now.
Yeah. And it's interesting, he was talking about making sure to the players that sometimes a long ball isn't a bad ball, it's a long pass, it's not giving the ball away, and that those messages are starting to come. Dominic Calvert-Lewin back in the team, and Doucouré, as I say, has been an absolute diamond, signed a long term contract, and you just get the sense that Everton are going to be okay this
season. I do as well,
and I don't think we'll be going to the last game of the season and them struggling to perform. Brighton 1, Sheffield United 1. I suppose a good point for Sheffield United, who were a goal down to Odingra, and then Webster with an own goal, being Sheffield United back in it. Dahoud actually came on for Brighton after 69 minutes. He was a substitute, got sent off for a bit of a stamp, which is a bit foolish.
Yeah, it was.
Under pressure. And then let's go to one of the informed teams at Villa Park. I think it's 18 home games now in Europe and in the Premier League that they've won. I mean, it's an incredible run by Unai Emery and his team. Own goal from Robinson got them off. John McGinn, the captain, swept a lovely ball in with his left foot. Ollie Watkins gets his customary goal after a breakaway. And Raul Jimenez with a bit of a consolation from Fulham's point of view. But Villa, I heard Unai Emery saying, you know, we can't be top four, we can't be top four. We'd like to be top six, but we can't be top four. And I'm thinking, you could be top four the way you're going and the way you're managing. And, you know, if you... ambitious owners maybe spend a bit of money in the January window and get a bit of depth. I mean, this team and this turnaround has been incredible.
Yeah, it has. I tipped them to get in the top four. I said this the start of the season, having seen Unai Emery firsthand in the summer series, I was blown away with him. Mm. I thought, what detail goes into it, how they organise the team, what they're all about, and I thought, I really fancy them to get in. The one thing that we didn't legislate for was the injury to Tyrone Mings and Buendia, two of the best like starters within the team. When you lose them, I'm thinking, oh, it's not good for them. Yeah. But how they've responded has been quite brilliant. Am I surprised at the run they've been on at Villa Park? 100% we are. Yeah. Am I surprised that they're so close to the top? No, having seen him firsthand. So incredible job that he's doing.
I remember when we sat with John McGinn and we were chatting and asking him, you know, you want to know what Emery's like? And I remember him saying, he's a bit crazy, but he's great. He said he is a bit crazy. Crazy work sometimes. And I'm just going to give you the opportunity for your underappreciated performer of the week, because it's an Aston Villa player. I'll give you the floor, sir.
Yeah, Moussa Diaby. I just think since he's come into the football club, he's taken a lot of pressure off Ollie Watkins. I think he's also taken pressure off John McGinn, because John McGinn was so often the one who had to create opportunities and to make those forward runs. Mm. Watkins was always the one who had to be the creator or a goal scorer himself. Whereas Diaby, I remember when he came into the club, I'm thinking, where's he going to play in this system? They don't play wingers, so what's he going to do? But he complements Watkins and McGinn so well. So he's my unsung hero, because as much as he does score and as much as he does create, I just think he's one that goes under the radar a little bit.
Yes, good shout. He's still young, he'll still grow, and you say that it's a
he won't grow taller.
No, he'll grow under the management of Unai Emery. And I think what's great for Villa is they can play him as a two, they can play one underneath, he can play from the wide positions, and he looks really committed to. So yeah, really good shout, Moussa Diaby, as your underappreciated performer of the week. Listen, mate, it's been brilliant.
Yeah.
You have to do this again. Get Musty wherever he is on a plane
somewhere
else. On a week when it was bonkers at the Bridge, Chelsea and Man City slugged it out for a 4-4 draw. Elsewhere, United get a win, but not a great performance. Everton, Liverpool, Arsenal and Villa, they got points and performances put together. We're going to take a well-earned break for the international weekend, but we're back on Sunday. That's November the 26th, when we'll recap match week 13, where Manchester City play Liverpool on Saturday and Everton host Manchester United on the Sunday. But for now, I'm Earl, he was Warnock. Together, we weren't the two Robbies. Thanks for watching and listening. Be safe, stay healthy. It's a good night from me. It's a good night from him. Good night.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
When something happens to your car, you might say,
"No! My car!"
But what you really need to say is something that can actually help.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just like that, State Farm is there to help you file your claim right on the State Farm mobile app. So just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.